The Achaemenid Empire lasted 208 years. The Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great lasted 231. The Roman Republic lasted 233. Romanov Russia lasted 234. Today, the United States of America is 244 years old. What happens next? Where do we go from here? What do we build out of the ashes? Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan, and these are notes from the end of time.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to our 9th episode of Notes from the End of Time. This one is not on Free Atlantic Voices because Free Atlantic Voices is no longer with us. For unspecified terms of service violations, we were booted from that host. I'm going to continue making Notes from the End of Time, distributing it on my own channel, which is modest, doesn't have quite the distribution that Tom Kaczynski's channel has, although you will still be seeing me on Tom Kaczynski's channel. I still hope to be working with Tom. I will still be bringing you cutting-edge and controversial topics like H.P. Lovecraft, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, a Catholic perspective on today's world. Believe it or not, I have been asked to leave social media outlets and internet service providers on more than one occasion. I have to admit, I never figured I'd get tossed off for being too Catholic, but the world is what it is. In the meantime, Notes from the End of Time with Kenaz Filan is still available on iTunes. We're available on SoundCloud. We're available on Google Play Podcasts. You can also find us on YouTube and BitChute. Interestingly, I am getting about 10 times the traffic on BitChute. Not getting a lot of traffic in either place, but about 10 times the traffic on BitChute, which I get on YouTube. As podcast personalities are wont to say, like and subscribe. And in my previous episodes, I've been talking about war, talking about a just war, asking people what our end game is as the current chaos continues. Today, I was going to offer some constructive suggestions toward how we could build a better society. These are based on a papal encyclical written in 1963 by Pope John XXIII called Pacem in Terris. That's peace on earth. And while it is a papal encyclical, Pope John's intended audience was not just the Catholic faithful, but as he put it, all men of good will. Pope John was putting those ideas out there for anybody who was interested in establishing universal peace and truth, justice, charity, and liberty. I think we're all interested in establishing that kind of universal peace, so let's see what Pope John had to say about it. The opening line is, "Peace on earth, which man throughout the ages has so longed for and sought after, can never be established, never guaranteed, except by the diligent observance of the divinely established order." And I understand that divinely established order thing is a little bit controversial nowadays. Pope John went on to say that a marvelous order predominates in the world of living beings and in the forces of nature is the plain lesson which the progress of modern research and the discoveries of technology teach us. And it is part of the greatness of man that he can appreciate that order and devise the means for harnessing those forces for his own benefit. But what emerges first and foremost from the progress of scientific knowledge and the inventions of technology is the infinite greatness of God himself, who created both man and the universe. Moreover, God created man in his own image and likeness, endowed him with intelligence and freedom, and made him Lord of creation. All this the psalmist proclaims when he says, Thou hast made him a little less than the angels. Thou hast crowned him with glory and honor, and hast set him over the works of thy hands. Thou hast subjected all things under his feet. Here we see that, like the founding fathers, Pope John believes that every human being is endowed with certain inalienable rights by a creator. And of course, there are many objections to that idea in the modern world. One of the most common objections being, if God created us in his own image, why are we such horrible beings? Why do we always fight with each other? Why do we always do these injustices? Pope John goes on with paragraph 4, says, and yet there is a disunity among individuals and among nations which is in striking contrast to this perfect order in the universe. One would think that the relationships that bind men together could only be governed by force. And today, more than one thinks that the relationships between men could only be governed by force. That seems to be the only way we know how to deal with the relationships between men. We silence people who say things we don't like. We beat people who have bad politics. We try to intimidate our opposition. Force is the go-to method today. Everybody has strong opinions, and everybody wants to shut down the other person's strong opinions. But that very strong feeling points to something. And here, John said, but the world's creator has stamped man's inmost being with an order revealed to man by his conscience, and his conscience insists on preserving it. Man is unique among animals in that, so far as we know, we are the only animal that agonizes over its actions in response to a moral code. We're the only animal capable of feeling guilt. To use a Christian term, we have the knowledge of good and evil. In Catholic teaching, the fall of man is what is called the felix culpa, the fortunate sin. Because Eve and Adam ate of the apple, that opened the way for the resurrection, and from there the redemption of man. Because we have the knowledge of good and evil, and that appears to be universal. Yes, there are differences across cultures as to what constitutes right and what constitutes wrong, but they line up in a lot of key areas. And the important thing is, across cultures, there is an idea of right and of wrong, and an idea that man can know right and yet do wrong, and that man is tempted to do wrong. And that knowledge of good and evil, that free will, and that propensity to sin are all part of the Catholic viewpoint, and on a greater level, part of the Christian viewpoint. There are no Christian denominations that will deny that man is a sinful being or will deny that man is capable of redemption. And any system which doesn't take all of those things into account is doomed to failure. As Pope John said, many people think that the laws which govern man's relations with the state are the same as those which regulate the blind elemental forces of the universe. But it is not so. The laws which govern men are quite different. The Father of the universe has inscribed them in man's nature, and that is where we must look for them, there and nowhere else. And today, our science, our philosophy, our politics, our economics deal with nothing but blind impersonal forces. We're sorted by demographic, by age, by income status. We become nothing but data points. What do we produce? What will we consume? What ad should we deliver to us? We've become cogs in a machine run by blind impersonal forces. Yet, as a society, we have not grown more just, and as individuals, we are certainly not happier. And how do we fix that? Pope John 23rd would note, any well-regulated and productive association of men in society demands the acceptance of one fundamental principle, that each individual man is truly a person. His is a nature that is endowed with intelligence and free will. As such, he has rights and duties, which together flow as a direct consequence from his nature. These rights and duties are universal and inviolable, and therefore altogether inalienable. John wrote this encyclical not just to the Catholic faithful, remember, this is to all men of good will. What John is saying is that any society, a Christian society, a non-Christian society, cannot be well regulated and productive unless it recognizes those inalienable rights of man. And what are those rights? Man has the right to live. He has the right to bodily integrity and to the means necessary for the proper development of life, particularly food, clothing, shelter, medical care, rest, and finally, the necessary social services. In consequence, he has the right to be looked after in the event of ill health, disability stemming from his work, widowhood, old age, enforced unemployment, or whenever through no fault of his own he is deprived of the means of his livelihood. And this is a common theme in Catholic thought. The Burgos Laws, which are the first human rights laws, were enacted in the Spanish Empire to protect the human rights of Indians to food, to not being worked to death in the mines, and to an education. And those were enacted thanks to diligent lobbying efforts from a Father Antonio de Montesiros and some other Dominican friars from Hispaniola. And of course, you can argue that the Church didn't do enough to stop racism or to prevent excesses against colonized peoples. But what you can't argue is they were the first voice to cry out for those rights. And while most of our social programs and our welfare programs concentrate on keeping the poor fed and content and poor, the Catholic Church and Pope John said, moreover, man has a natural right to be respected. He has a right to his good name. He has a right to freedom in investigating the truth and, within the limits of the moral order and the common good, to freedom of speech and publication, and to freedom to pursue whatever profession he may choose. He has the right, also, to be accurately informed about public events. And that, again, is not something new. The laws of Burgos forbade a Spanish colonist from calling an Indian dog or addressing him by anything but his proper name. We understand you need more than just a content and fed populace. You need a population that feels respected. And if you're a Catholic, every human being, without exception, is possessed of an immortal soul made in the image of God, and every human life, without exception, is sacred from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death. You don't need bi pride, fat pride, envy pride, whatever kind of pride you think you need. You have innate value because you have a soul made in the image of God, and your life is sacred from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death. And Pope John recognized another right which is really not taken seriously today, the right to be accurately informed about public events. Your government should never, under any circumstances, have the right to lie to you. Yes, there may be times when information needs to be withheld for the public good, though I'd like those times to be as few as possible, and I'd like some pretty stringent regulations on what needs to be kept secret. But your government should never, under any circumstances, have the right to tell its population a falsehood. Your government should not have the right to suppress information which it finds inconvenient. Your government should not have the right to tell you that something did not happen when it did. It does not have the right to blame an attack on our civilians on a convenient target rather than on the people who actually did it. All those rights have been trampled on over the past few years, and I think they are going to need to be the hallmark of any just civilization going forward. Politicians are not allowed to lie. Technocratic plutocrats are not allowed to protect us from information for our own good. We have the right to the truth. We have the responsibility and the right to investigate the truth. Every man has a right to receive a good general education and a technical or professional training consistent with the degree of educational development in his own country. Furthermore, a system must be devised for affording gifted members of society the opportunity of engaging in more advanced studies with a view to their occupying, as far as possible, positions of responsibility in society in keeping with their natural talent and acquired skill. And that provision for gifted members of the society is so important for everybody. No child should be shut out of getting an education. No person should be shut out of getting an education on the basis of race, ethnicity, creed, color, any incidentals. Every individual should receive the best education they can receive, and those individuals who are more gifted should receive an education consistent with them reaching their highest and best ability. No one should be denied the opportunity for advancement, but here's another important thing. Nobody should be treated as a lesser human being because they lack the qualifications to advance above a humble station. That kid who dropped out of 8th grade at age 18 and now works as a farmhand is every bit as much a human being and a child of God as his classmate who went on to medical school. And I think that's an important difference between the Catholic worldview as espoused by John and our modern secular worldview. The Pope saw education as a human right. We've come to see it as an indicator of human value. And you hear a lot of talk today about fundamentalist Taliban and Christian theocracy, and we're all want to create something out of The Handmaid's Tale. According to Pope John the 23rd, also among man's rights is that of being able to worship God in accordance with the right dictates of his own conscience and to profess his religion, both in private and in public. And this gets back to that idea of free will that I talked about earlier. According to Christian tradition, and I agree with G.K. Chesterton that it's the most easily proven of all Christian assertions, humanity is capable of knowing the difference between good and evil, and yet often knowingly and willingly chooses to do evil. Christ died on the cross so that all those who chose to follow him might receive the gift of eternal life. But it is important that the individual make the conscious choice to follow Christ just as the individual makes the conscious choice to sin. The church can and should have a say in social policy. The church can and should have a say in social policy and political affairs, just as any other large organization of like-minded individuals should. If the teachers' union can offer their thoughts on an education bill and the AFL-CIO on a presidential election, the Pope certainly should be allowed to offer his thoughts on abortion, or a local church to offer their thoughts on a gay pride parade. But you cannot, by force of law, make people accept Christ in their hearts and make them believe in Christ. And a personal acceptance of God's gift, becoming part of that redemption, is key in every denomination of Christianity. For Reformed and Evangelical Protestants, it's the only step that matters. Catholics would add in the sacraments and a few other things. Calvinists will tell you that only a few people are predestined to be members of the elect who make that personal decision. But everybody agrees the individual's got to make that personal choice, and you can't make that personal choice with a gun against your head. Yes, there have been situations in Christian history where conversion by the sword took place. We generally frown on it now because, we realize not only isn't it an affront to God and the taking of innocent life, it doesn't work very well. When it comes to building a Christian community, feeding the poor and healing the sick does a lot more to win followers and hearts than lining people up and offering them the choice of convert or die. And for American Catholics, there's also a personal interest. For most of American history, Roman Catholics were not only a minority, they were a persecuted minority. We faced discrimination in housing. There were Catholics killed in anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic riots in a number of American cities. We understand that any time you start seeing religious discrimination, if they start by burning mosques or they start by burning synagogues, sooner or later they are going to get around to desecrating our Madonnas and our crucifixes. Our faith has been around for 2,000 years and counting. I have confidence that we can survive in a free marketplace of ideas and that we can defend our traditions by correcting lies and by presenting truth. I would also note that many of those who scream the loudest about fundamentalist Taliban are happy to try to re-educate an entire society to conform with their ideology via various workshops, programs, public shamings, and every other tool they have at their disposal. So far, there really hasn't been a lot that Pope John XXIII said that would draw ire from even a far-left person who read it with an open mind. It's pretty much in keeping with modern humanist thought. Paragraphs 15 through 17 of Pacem in Terris really highlight differences between the Catholic worldview and the postmodern secular view. In the postmodern secular view, the individual is predominant. The major focus is on individual rights, allowing individuals to express themselves, even if those expressions seem eccentric or deviant to community norms. There's much less focus on the nuclear family. If anything, the authoritarian patriarchal model of the family is seen as outmoded and even actively hostile to development. What Pope John XXIII said was, human beings also have the right to choose for themselves the life which appeals to them, whether it is to found a family, in the founding of which both the man and woman enjoy equal rights and duties, or to embrace the priesthood or the religious life. The family, founded upon marriage, freely contracted, one indissoluble, must be regarded as the natural, primary cell of human society. The interests of the family, therefore, must be taken very specially into consideration in social and economic affairs, as well as in the spheres of faith and morals, for all of these have to do with strengthening the family and assisting it in the fulfillment of its mission. Of course, the support and education of children is a right which belongs primarily to the parents. And if you're not interested in settling down and having children, and a lot of people nowadays aren't, you may find this focus threatening. And again, the church recognizes, and any just society will have to recognize, that there is a role and a place for single people, for people who, for whatever reason, are not interested in the heterosexual marriage with children model. But that model has worked in the West for centuries. It produced reasonably stable, happy societies. There was always a place in town for spinster aunts. You saw pansies in vaudeville shows. As I'm always fond of reminding people, we've known what sodomy was since the days of Sodom, but while the Catholic Church always condemned sodomy as a sin, they did hire a rather notorious sodomite to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It is much easier to build a stable society of happy extended families living alongside each other, working together to help raise the children, with fathers who function as authority figures, you know, with mothers who handle the finances and who also work with raising the children. Those traditional models became traditional because they worked. They weren't created by a bunch of old white men steepling their fingers and trying to figure out a way to enforce white supremacy forever. They lasted for centuries because they were the best model for creating a stable Western society. That doesn't mean we want to enforce it at gunpoint, but the point is we don't have to enforce it at gunpoint. Left to our own devices, we seem to fall into this sort of, if for lack of a better word, monogamish, emotionally monogamous couples that raise children together. And that seems to be a pretty good working model. There are less families following this model now. There are more children being raised in single-parent households. But I'm not sure those children are the better for it. And by a lot of rubrics, it appears that children that are raised in non-traditional households come at a significant disadvantage. We can fight for the rights of identity groups that nobody ever heard of 2 weeks ago. Why would we, why do we not fight for stronger families, for measures that will keep families together? Why do we not fight for a society that encourages traditional marriage? Why do we not fight to work towards a situation where extended families can still live together in close proximity to each other, where we can have those villages of families which were the backbone of society for most of, not just Western history, for most of our recorded history? Why would we not look at the ways in which our modern capitalist globalist system has torn apart families, starting with the creation of the, quote, nuclear family, unquote, that the mid-20th century tried to sell us an image of the nuclear family on situation comedies? The nuclear family was only created to replace the extended family when the interstates and the rise of the post-war defense industry sent whole families moving across the nation after Dad got transferred to a new job with his promotion. Today's rise in sexual permissiveness has given us a generation of young women who see getting their first OnlyFans account as a coming-of-age ritual, and a generation of young men who have little interest in women at all, save the ones they look at the screen with the hand lotion next to them. And no, I'm not saying ban pornography and ban birth control. As a Roman Catholic, I am obligated to say ban abortion. But I do think it's worthwhile to tally up the social and the economic and the personal costs that the sexual revolution wrought upon our society. We keep hearing about the glories of feminism. There was a dark side to feminism, and I think we need to acknowledge that. Again, we're Catholics. All people are born sinners. Any human institution is going to be tainted by human sin. You can learn from other organizations. You can even acknowledge achievements they made or great things they did while disagreeing with their core message and thinking their main impact being an overall evil. There's room in our society for non-traditional lifestyles, for non-traditional marriages, for non-traditional families, but they are always going to be the exception to the rule. If that makes you feel uncomfortable, that's on you. You have the right to live your life as you see fit, privately and publicly. You don't have the right to a cheering section. People have conflated the right to tolerance with the right to adulation. Only in a stable community with strong families can there be the kind of peace and abundance of resources that generally makes for higher tolerance of diverse opinions and diverse people and diverse cultures. And church teaching is pretty clear on the rights of workers. The economic rights, as John put it, a man has the inherent right not only to be given the opportunity to work, but also to be allowed the exercise of personal initiative in the work that he does. The conditions in which a man works form a necessary corollary to these rights. They must not be such as to weaken his physical or moral fiber, or militate against the proper development of adolescence to manhood. Women must be accorded such conditions of work as are consistent with their needs and responsibilities as wives and mothers. The worker is likewise entitled to a wage that is determined in accordance with the precepts of justice. This needs stressing. The amount a worker receives must be sufficient in proportion to available funds to allow him and his family a standard of living consistent with human dignity. Pope Pius XII expressed it in these terms: nature imposes work upon man as a duty, and man has the corresponding natural right to demand that the work he does shall provide him with the means of livelihood for himself and his children. Such is nature's categorical imperative for the preservation of man. He has the right to the private ownership of property, including that of productive goods. This, as we have said elsewhere, is a right which constitutes so efficacious a means of asserting one's personality and exercising responsibility in every field, and an element of solidity and security for family life, and of greater peace and prosperity in the state. Finally, it is opportune to point out that the right to own private property entails a social obligation as well. This is the second time we're talking about rights and duties. As you can see, the church is really clear on this. A worker has the right to an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. They were very clear that the working men were allowed to form working men's guilds and unions, but they also recognized that every right comes with a corresponding duty. As a worker, you have a duty to put in an honest day's work for your pay. If your employer does not meet the obligation of providing you an honest day's pay, you have the right to strike. You have the right to own a factory. You have the duty to pay your workers a fair wage and to provide them with safe conditions. You have a right to free speech. You have a duty to speak the truth. As John puts it, to claim one's rights and ignore one's duties, or only half fulfill them, is like building a house with one hand and tearing it down with the other. He also went on to say, it is useless to admit that a man has a right to the necessities of life unless we also do all in our power to supply him with means sufficient for his livelihood. Hence, society must not only be well ordered, it must also provide men with abundant resources. This postulates not only the mutual recognition and fulfillment of rights and duties, but also the involvement and collaboration of all men in the many enterprises which our present civilization makes possible, encourages, or indeed demands. 2 years before writing Pacem Terris, John released a 1961 encyclical entitled Mater et Magistra. This was written on the 70th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, a groundbreaking work on the rights of the working poor by Pope Leo XIII. As you can see, the Roman Catholic Church has actually had a fairly long history of being in support of workers' rights, despite its reputation as being head pusher for the opiate to the masses. In that work, John said, "The question of work must be regarded not merely as a commodity, but as a specifically human activity. In the majority of cases, a man's work is his sole means of livelihood. Its remuneration, therefore, cannot be made to depend on the state of the market. It must be determined by the laws of justice and equity. Any other procedure would be a clear violation of justice, even supposing the contract of work to have been freely entered into by both parties. Secondly, private ownership of property, including that of productive goods, is a natural right which the state cannot suppress, but it naturally entails a social obligation as well. It is a right which must be exercised not only for one's own personal benefit, but also for the benefit of others. As for the state, its whole raison d'etre is the realization of the common good in the temporal order. It cannot, therefore, hold aloof from economic matters. On the contrary, it must do all in its power to promote the production of a sufficient supply of material goods, the use of which is necessary for the practice of virtue. It also has the duty to protect the rights of all its people, and particularly of its weaker members, the workers, women, and children. It can never be right for the state to shirk its obligation of working actively for the betterment of the condition of the working man. Finally, both workers and employers should regulate their mutual relations in accordance with the principle of human solidarity and Christian brotherhood. Unrestricted competition in the liberal sense and the Marxist creed of class warfare are clearly contrary to Christian teaching in the nature of man. These, venerable brethren, are the basic principles upon which a genuine social and economic order must be built." Pope John also acknowledged the right of a human being to emigrate to other countries and take up residence when there are just reasons in favor of it, and he did note that the fact that he is a citizen of a particular state does not deprive him of membership in the human family, nor of citizenship in that universal society, the common worldwide fellowship of man. And as somebody who's been critical of immigration in the past and is critical of immigration in the present, I agree that it's important that we keep in mind that these immigrants are fellow human beings. I live in a neighborhood with a lot of first-generation and second-generation immigrants. Yes, I think that demographic shifts in a country can and generally do lead to social tensions. I think that immigrants have been used as a tool to depress working man's wages in the United States and elsewhere. They've also regularly been exploited by people who wanted to use their labor and get around OSHA laws. It's all right to ask those questions, but it's also important to remember that these immigrants are by and large people who just came here in search of a better life. My quarrel is with the NGOs and human smugglers who get rich off their misery. My quarrel is with the sweatshops that profiteer off their sweat. My quarrel's not with these people. As John put it in Pacem, Before a society can be considered well-ordered, creative, and consonant with human dignity, it must be based on truth. Human society, as we here picture it, demands that men be guided by justice, respect the rights of others, and do their duty. It demands, too, that they be animated by such love as will make them feel the needs of others as their own, and induce them to share their goods with others, and to strive in the world to make all men alike heirs to the noblest of intellectual and spiritual values. Nor is this enough, for human society thrives on freedom, namely, on the use of means which are consistent with the dignity of its individual members who, being endowed with reason, assume responsibility for their own actions. A regime which governs solely or mainly by means of threats and intimidation or promises of reward provides men with no effective incentive to work for the common good. And even if it did, it would certainly be offensive to the dignity of free and rational human beings. Authority is before all else a moral force. For this reason, the appeal of rulers should be to the individual conscience, to the duty which every man has of voluntarily contributing to the common good. But since all men are equal in natural dignity, no man has the capacity to force internal compliance on another. Only God can do that, for he alone scrutinizes and judges the secret counsels of the heart. Governmental authority, therefore, is a postulate of the moral order and derives from God. Consequently, laws and decrees passed in contravention of the moral order, and hence of the divine will, can have no binding force in conscience, since it is right to obey God rather than men. Indeed, the passing of such laws undermines the very nature of authority and results in shameful abuse. As St. Thomas teaches, in regard to the second proposition, we maintain that human law has the rationale of law insofar as it is in accordance with right reason, and as such it obviously derives from eternal law. A law which is at variance with reason is to that extent unjust and has no longer the rationale of law. It is rather an act of violence. He also offered a little bit of advice which may prove useful today in our era of endless programs aimed at tearing down white supremacism and fixing all sorts of social problems. The common welfare further demands that in their efforts to coordinate and protect, and their efforts to promote the rights of citizens, the civil authorities preserve a delicate balance. An excessive concern for the rights of any particular individuals or groups might well result in the principal advantages of the state being in effect monopolized by these citizens. Or again, the absurd situation can arise where the civil authorities, while taking measures to protect the rights of citizens, themselves stand in the way of the full exercise of these rights. For this principle must always be retained, that however extensive and far-reaching the influence of the state on the economy must be, it must never be exerted to the extent of depriving the individual citizen of his freedom of action. It must rather augment his freedom while effectively guaranteeing the protection of everyone's essential personal rights. I think we've all seen where that one leads us so far, haven't we? And today we're talking an awful lot about global economies and the global community and globalism. John the 23rd was writing around the time of the birth of the United Nations. It's just coming into power as a real force. He was very optimistic about it, but he saw the United Nations as a loose confederation of nations working together. His major interest was not bringing everybody together under a one-world government. It was seeing that the citizens of Africa and South Asia and other places where colonial rule was ending were treated with fairness and dignity and were allowed to build their own states. As he put it, the mutual ties between states must be governed by truth. Truth calls for the elimination of every trace of racial discrimination and the consequent recognition of the inviolable principle that all states are by nature equal in dignity. Each of them accordingly has the right to exist, to develop, and to possess the necessary means and accept a primary responsibility for its own development. Each is also legitimately entitled to its good name and to the respect which it is due. As we know from experience, men frequently differ widely in knowledge, virtue, intelligence, and wealth, but that is no valid argument in favor of a system whereby those who are in a position of superiority impose their will arbitrarily on others. On the contrary, such men have a greater share in the common responsibility to help others to reach perfection by their mutual efforts. So too, on the international level, some nations may have attained to a superior degree of scientific, cultural, and economic development, but that does not entitle them to exert unjust political domination over other nations. It means that they have to make a greater contribution to the common cause of social progress. So who is a nation and who's a state? That's a really tricky question. Are the Taiwanese a state? They say so. Nobody else agrees with them because they're too afraid of the People's Republic of China. Are the Kurds a people? Most people would agree that they are, but there is no Kurdistan. In 1900, Palestine was a backwater of the Ottoman province, occupied by a bunch of farmers that had been there for centuries. They didn't start calling themselves Palestinians till after the 1948 war, and come to think of it, there were no Israelis before then either. Today, everybody knows who Palestinians are, and everybody knows who the Israelis are. Pope John noted, "That political trend, which since the 19th century has become widespread throughout the world and has gained in strength, in which men of similar ethnic background are anxious for political autonomy and unification into a single nation. For many reasons, this cannot always be effected, and consequently, minority peoples are often obliged to live within the territories of a nation of a different ethnic origin. This situation gives rise to serious problems. It is quite clear that any attempt to check the vitality and growth of these ethnic minorities is a flagrant violation of justice, the more so if such perverse efforts are aimed at their very extinction. Indeed, the best interests of justice are served by those public authorities who do all they can to improve the human conditions of the members of these minority groups, especially in what concerns their language, culture, ancient traditions, and their economic activity and enterprise." As I have said before, I expect we're going to see a pretty significant demographic shift within the United States in the wake of the George Floyd protests. The cities that were hit hardest by riots are certainly going to become poorer. They're going to become darker complected. You're going to see a lot of white flight out of those areas. And while I think many of the liberals who are leaving will hold on to a lot of their liberal ideals, I think you're also going to see a pretty decided shift to the hard right with many of them. And a lot of people who wouldn't say racist things in public will begin saying them to their friends and taking those racist ideas into account where they choose where to relocate. We've already seen in several instances when people tried to take BLM protests into smaller towns and into suburbs, they were met with a hostile audience. Quite a few times that hostile audience was brandishing guns. So far, nobody's been shot in those situations, with the exception of the Kenosha shooting. That will change if people keep trying to push into those areas. I think we've seen the battle lines for where things are shaping up, and those lines are going to be redrawn, if they get redrawn, in blood. This will certainly lead to increased tensions between various groups in the United States. I expect this. I'm not saying it with any joy, but I think it's an obvious consequence of what has been going on. But I don't expect a world where we've got Greater Caucasia, New Wakanda, and Mexico Norte. We're going to have lots of situations where people are living amongst each other. We're going to have lots of situations where people are living alongside each other. We're going to have to learn how to treat each other with respect. We're going to have to learn how to respect each other's cultures. And for a while after this, we very well may have to learn how to respect each other's boundaries. But we are going to be responsible for shaping that future. We're going to have to draw those lines and we're going to have to talk to each other. Once again, getting back to Pachamon Terrace, perhaps the best reproach would be, as Pope Pius XII said, a new order founded on moral principles is the surest bulwark against the violation of the freedom, integrity, and security of other nations, no matter what may be their territorial extension or their capacity for defense. For although it is almost inevitable that the larger states, in view of their greater power and vaster resources, will themselves decide on the norms governing their economic associations with small states, nevertheless, these smaller states cannot be denied their right, in keeping with the common good, to political freedom and to the adoption of a position of neutrality in the conflicts between nations. No state can be denied this right, for it is a postulate of the natural law itself, as also of international law. These smaller states have also the right of assuring their own economic development. It is only with the effective guaranteeing of these rights that smaller nations can fittingly promote the common good of all mankind, as well as the material welfare and the cultural and spiritual progress of their own people. The solutions to our problems are not going to come from Washington. They're not going to be delivered by Amazon. The solutions to our problem will only be found among our people, in our communities. A peaceful solution to our problems will only come when we stop looking at each other as enemies and start seeing fellow brothers and sisters in Christ and fellows in the brotherhood of man. This isn't a perfect solution. It won't bring about a utopia. Beware of anybody who ever tries to sell you a utopia. Some of the nastiest hells on earth have been created by people that were trying to create heaven. What this can be is a framework for how we rebuild our world and a framework for how we rebuild our community. And the most important thing of all, it can be the framework for how we start to rebuild ourselves. We've been poisoned physically. We've been poisoned spiritually. We've been demoralized. We need recovery. We need the grail. We need to get back in touch with those eternal truths, and we need to use those eternal truths to heal ourselves and our land. You don't have to accept the Pope. You don't even have to accept Jesus, though I think you'd probably be happier if you did. But all I ask that you do is look at the truths I offered here. Look at Pachamon Terrace. Use that as a source for a model of how you would build that better world and that better community out of ashes, because pretty soon, my friends, we're going to be doing just that. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, this has been the 9th episode of Notes from the End of Time. I'm Kenaz Filan. Thank you very much for listening, and may God bless us each and every one.